Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us this hour on the show. Coming up, with record temperatures this week, what are authorities doing to keep the public and workers safe? And we'll take a step back in time to look at a 19th century land fraud scheme and what it says about race in the Southwest.
But first, the Federal Transit Administration has set aside $100 million for the South Central extension to the Valley's light rail system. The project has been a controversial one, and Phoenix voters next month will vote on whether or not to go ahead with it. Scott Smith, Valley Metro CEO, is with me to talk more about this. And Scott, I would imagine, first off, that you're pretty happy about this money coming in from the feds.
Well, we're very excited because this is a major milestone in the South Central extension downtown hub project to receive this commitment from the federal government.
What specifically will this money be paying for?
The federal government is a partner in the light rail extension into South Phoenix and the downtown work we're doing, and they're going to pay well over $500 million total if this project is built. So this is, in essence, the first installment of their agreement to partner with us to pay almost half the cost of this total project.
Now, you mentioned if this project gets built, and at this moment, it seems like there is some amount of if involved in that. If Phoenix voters approve Proposition 105 next month, what happens to this money? Does it just go away?
Well, it goes away. We were one of 12 projects nationwide that received allocations yesterday from the Federal Transit Administration, and these allocations are project-specific. So if Prop 105 is passed in August, then, of course, the light rail extensions are canceled in Phoenix, and this money would then go back to the Federal Transit Administration to be reallocated to other projects around the country.
Does it say anything that the federal government approved this money, given some of the uncertainty with the South Central extension?
An allocation is subject to the finalization of a funding agreement. But if we move forward and we fit all of the we meet all of the requirements of the FTA, which we have so far from the federal standpoint, then this will be funded. It's done really without consideration of the election, assuming that the election goes forward, and if the voters approve moving forward with this project, the federal government will be there. This isn't a subject to by the federal government. It's just sort of a statement of fact. We're either going to build the project with the approval of the voters or not build the project. And if we do, then the federal government has said that they've already allocated the first $100 million as their share of the project.
So I have to ask about the timing of this, with ballots for that August election hitting mailboxes in just a couple of weeks. Any concern that the timing of this announcement might seem suspicious to some folks?
Well, I'd like to think that the Federal Transit Administration does their job based on local conditions. But as I said, they made a major announcement yesterday. We were one of 12 projects nationwide. Each of those projects in places like Los Angeles, Boston, Dallas, Seattle. I don't really think that the timing of our election factored into the FDA's timing of this announcement.
If the project goes forward, at what point do you expect to actually get the money from D.C.?
If it goes forward, the money will actually come in probably beginning in late 2020. So we're still a year off. This is a current budget cycle allocation. It has to be spent by December of next year. So I would imagine it would come in then. What the federal government does is they reimburse costs. They don't advance costs. So once construction starts, if the voters allow the construction to go forward, once it starts, then we'll start building and we'll submit to the FTA for reimbursement of those expenses. These are multi-year projects. They're what are called pipeline projects, which means you have to meet certain requirements as you move forward and reach certain milestones with the FTA. And at South Central, we have been working for several years, and we're at the point in time where to get an allocation means that we've done all we need to, we've met all the requirements, and now the federal government is willing to step up commit, and that's a big deal. That is a very, very big milestone, and we're very excited about it. And now it's in the hands of the voters of Phoenix to see if we'll actually move forward or not.
That's Valley Metro CEO Scott Smith. We also spoke with Susan Godino with Building a Better Phoenix. That's the group opposed to the current plan for light rail expansion in South Phoenix and advocating for Prop 105. She questioned the timing of the announcement coming a week weeks before Phoenix voters can cast early ballots on the measure, which would stop all current and future funding for light rail projects in Phoenix.
It's one of the most important and difficult jobs in state government, running the agency responsible for dealing with child abuse and neglect. The director of the Department of Child Safety announced he is resigning September 1st. Greg McKay has been on the job 4.5 years. In that time, he's had to deal with record numbers of kids coming into the child welfare system. He was also tasked with reforming the state agency plagued by high turnover and low employee morale. In a moment, we'll talk to the head of a citizens board charged with monitoring the Department of Child Safety about what McKay's departure means to the agency and the kids in foster care throughout Arizona. But first, we turn to Mary Jo Pitzel, who covers child welfare issues for the Arizona Republic. Good morning, Mary Jo.
Hi, Kristen. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Lauren.
I understand. So he was, McKay was criticized from the beginning for not having the experience necessary for the position. There were people who said that he wasn't the right guy for the job. Tell us a little bit about how he came into this position 4.5 years ago.
Greg McKay, when DCS was created, was working as the head of the Office of Child Welfare Investigations, which was an office within the then Child Protective Services. That unit was created to investigate criminal abuse cases. So, and he was placed there because of his experience as a Phoenix police detective who investigated a lot of crimes against children. After DCS was created and this office moved over to underneath the DCS umbrella, he was promoted to agency director soon after Governor Ducey was elected. Ducey fired the then director, Charles Flanagan, whom Jim Brewer had put in place. And there had been some feuding between these two men about how cases were being handled. A lot of internal disputes, but the new governor decided to go with Mr. McKay and sent Mr. Flanagan packing.
Right. So when he took over this agency, it was sort of supposed to be a fresh start for the agency the year before that. And his first few years, he faced some challenges. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about some of the bumps in the road along the way.
Sure. It was pretty rocky to start with. I mean, to begin with, this new agency had inherited a huge caseload of reports. It was in the wake of the recession, you know, usually when social supports go downhill, reports of child abuse and neglect go up. And that was the case with DCS back in, after the 2010 recession. There were also problems just getting the ship righted, getting policies in place, trying to understand the staff, trying to stem the turnover of workers. It didn't help that early on they imposed a dress code that sort of required office dress for the case managers. A lot of people thought that really made a disconnect with the kind of families that they were sent out to work with. Mm-hmm. There was a huge backlog of cases, which just they needed to get to, and there wasn't enough money. The legislature appropriated money. Nothing was happening for a while, and finally the legislature really put its foot down and kept up the pressure on DCS, and that helped to turn things around. At the same time, the agency got a lot of help from the governor's lean management initiative, which helped to streamline a lot of the procedures.
And Mary Kay, in the 30 seconds or so we have left, give us a sense of where the agency is now and how Greg McKay is going out.
Well, they've certainly brought down the number of kids who are, you know, are in the foster care system. It's at about 13,500 today compared to I think a high point of nearly 19,000. There's an effort to try to keep families together rather than removing children as much, but in recent months we've seen a little uptick in the number of kids coming into the system. We're not quite sure why, but he's leaving as there is a bit of a crisis going on. We don't have enough foster beds for children of all ages, including the very youngest ones, who are usually very easy to place.
Yeah. All right. That's Mary Jo Pitzel with the Arizona Republic. Mary Jo, thank you for coming on.
Great. Thank you very much.
And our next guest chairs the DCS Advisory Committee, a citizen review panel that provides oversight of the Department of Child Safety. Emily Jenkins is president and CEO of the Arizona Council of Human Service Providers, which represents agencies contracted by DCS. Emily, welcome.
Thank you.
So what do you make of the fact that Greg McKay is leaving now? We just heard Mary Jo talking about some of the challenges that he leaves DCS with. What is the state of this agency at this moment?
Well, this agency is in a lot better shape than it was when he came in. It took a long time. I think Greg made some of the mistakes that you might predict from someone who had never run anything more than a small department within a big agency. He and his team thought they could just sort of issue a new policy and it would make its way down to the basic level of case managers or case workers. And it took them a while to understand what it takes to actually change the culture. When he came in, after all the disruptions that had occurred with the moving the department and the year under Flanagan and then this new administration, the caseworkers were afraid not to move children, and they were afraid to return them. So it took a lot to build more confidence, and I think he did build a confidence that the caseworkers would be backed in their judgments. What we saw over time was a gradual move towards getting more stability, more credibility with the staff and the community. We had a major hiccup in 2016 when we had really serious problems with the procurement process. That's contracting for services. And our members were being told, we'll pay you 60% of your cost and you can make up the rest with philanthropy. Well, I had one member who said, I already put $1 million worth of philanthropy running this shelter for your kids. I can't do anymore. And others said, we're businesses. We don't have any philanthropic dollars. So we had to go to the governor and we had to do a lot of stuff. And in the end, I went to Greg and I said, are we going to work together in partnership? And he said, we made a mistake. And I thought that was a pretty major admission from a director. We made a mistake and we're going to fix it. And then he assigned Mike Faust, who is the deputy director, to work on building better relationships and more constructive relationships with the providers. Mike Faust is staying. He's the deputy director. And that's important because there are two huge challenges coming up within the next two years. The federal government, through the Family First Services and Prevention Act, is changing the entire way we do child welfare. They are mandating more services up front, more prevention, intervention, more family preservation. We think this is a really good thing. However, it takes huge changes in the way that everyone works. And almost 80% or more of the DCS services to foster children, families, are done by contract agencies, not by the department. So we all have to get our workforce trained and recruited and ready. The other thing that's coming is they are moving the behavioral health program for the children, the foster children, in the CMDP, the Child Medical Dental Program, into the department to be administered and not out in the behavioral health system. So we are seeing huge transitions coming up. So whenever you lose a director in the middle of these major changes, it makes you nervous.
What kinds of qualities or qualifications would you be looking for and would your members be looking for in whoever the governor selects as the new director?
Well, I don't think we have time to go back and train somebody. And they don't have, there's not the opportunity for a huge learning curve. So I think we need someone who has a really extensive child welfare experience and knowledge running a big agency. This is an agency with thousands of employees all over the state. So that They have two really good senior managers. They have Mike Faust and Shalom Jacobs. And if a director could come in with their support and basically pick things up, but not have to spend a lot of time learning on the job, I think that's going to be really critical.
Do you see that person in state already, or do you think the state's going to have to go outside?
I got a call from the governor's office yesterday morning alerting me to this change and asking me that question. And I have to say, I don't know of anyone in the state at present who might be able to do this. We are certainly looking around to see if we might find someone. This is a big, complicated agency with very lots of cycles up and down, and a real need to be very politically aware, to work with the courts and work with law enforcement and work with social service. So you need, if someone came in from out of state, we would want them to know the business so they then could spend their time getting to know the state.
All right. That is Emily Jenkins, President and CEO of the Arizona Council of Human Service Providers, which represents agencies contracted by DCS. Emily, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Heat-related deaths are all too common in Arizona. In 2018, excessively hot temperatures claimed 182 lives in the Phoenix area, according to Maricopa County Department of Public Health. It was a new record, and the numbers continue to rise. Concerns about heat exposure for workers are what prompted Arizona Representative Raul Grijalva, alongside Democratic Representatives Judy Chu and Alma Adams, to introduce a new bill that looks to protect workers from heat stress. The Asuncion Valdivia Heat Illness and Fatality Prevention Act would set federal heat standards that ensure the safety and health of workers. Grijalva said at a press conference this morning in D.C. that Arizona's workers are particularly vulnerable to extreme heat, and with climate change, the blazing temperatures will only get worse. For more on this, I got a hold of Robert Weissman, president of the advocacy organization Public Citizen.
There's a serious problem in this country, and there has been for a long time, of workers being exposed to excessively high heat. This includes a lot of indoor workers as it happens, but it's especially a problem for outdoor workers, farm workers particularly, construction workers, and many others. Extreme heat stress is a killer. More than 700 workers died in the last 25 years from extreme heat stress, and that's what's reported. The real number is surely much higher. Tens of thousands injured. And this is all going to get much worse with the climate crisis. The administration is refusing to act administratively on this, and so Representative Chu is taking a leadership role in introducing legislation that would mandate a new heat stress protection for all workers in the United States.
There are some protections, right, for workers in extreme cold. Why is this something that hasn't had any attention brought to it yet?
Well, there's no good reason for it, except that the most affected workers are a population that don't get enough attention in the United States, including even from our Department of Labor. There have been some efforts. So California has, and some other states as well, have heat stress protections. The California standard was actually led by Representative Chu when she was in the state legislature in California. And the federal agency, OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, did do one important thing, which was in the wake of the BP Deep Horizon disaster, when there was a massive cleanup effort in the Gulf of Mexico, and you had workers out in the blazing hot sun on the water for 10 or 12 hours a day. OSHA imposed on BP the kind of heat standard that we are now calling for. And the result was those workers who otherwise for sure would have had not just exposures, but major heat stress events did not.
And so let's talk exactly about what this would do. So it would require OSHA to promulgate a heat stress standard. What exactly does that mean?
There are a lot of elements to it, but the core elements are really common sense. The ways to prevent heat stress are to ensure that people have access to cool water, to give them shade when they're in the outside from time to time, and to give them rest breaks. So it's water, shade, and rest. That's the core element of what a standard would be.
That seems so obvious, I guess. Is it something that the market really isn't already doing? Like, doesn't it make sense that a business would want their workers to be safe enough that they could keep working?
You might think that, but you would be wrong. So no, the market totally fails, and that's why we have so many workers dying and suffering completely preventable illness from heat exposure. If you think about the farm workers in particular, where you know the protections are minimal, the workers are highly vulnerable, the work is hard, and crucially, the workers are typically paid by the piece. So they've got an incentive to work as hard as they possibly can for as long as they possibly can, and the employers are pushing them in that direction. No, the growers will not provide these minimal protections, and the workers suffer as a result. By contrast, in California, where, although there's still enforcement problems there, things have improved dramatically in the wake of the standards that were imposed now more than a decade ago.
All right. That's Robert Weissman, president of Public Citizen. Robert, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
And here in Arizona, the heat is at the top of everyone's mind as we are looking forward to temps over 110 for the next several days. And this kind of heat is bringing out a network of people here in the valley who work to help keep us all safe. Maria Pina coordinates the Heat Relief Network for the Maricopa Association of Governments, and she came into our studios recently to tell me more about it. The network is all about organizing the community to keep people safe when it's hot outside. It's made up of nonprofits, faith-based groups, service providers, and businesses who all come together around this common goal. They provide refuse stations, hydration stations, and collection points all over the valley for anyone who needs to get out of the heat, get a drink of water, and cool down.
The heat is called a silent killer for a good reason. People assume that you can go about your day and work outside and not drink water, not hydrate properly. It's important for the public to be aware of the dangers of the heat, to stay well hydrated and stay out of the heat. Take breaks as often as necessary, especially if you have health conditions, if you're working outside, or if you really just need the respite from the heat.
How many people actually die from the heat every year here in Arizona?
It's amazing to think about this, but there are more heat-associated deaths per year than any other inclement weather. More people die due to the heat than any other type of weather. And so it's important for the public to prevent these heat-related deaths because they are preventable. All you need to do is know the dangers of heat, be able to have access to water and stay out of the heat.
Who are what are the demographics like on that? Like, I think we would all assume that it's people experiencing homelessness who cannot necessarily get out of the heat who are going to be the ones who die from this. But I understand that's not always the case.
No. You know, when the Heat Relief Network was formed in 2005, the focus was homelessness because in 2005 there was a heat wave that killed about 30 persons across the region in the time span of a week. And it was shocking to hear that people can die from heat. How can people die from heat, from lack of resources to or access to water, a respite from the heat? But it happened. And so the community came together to find a solution to this problem. And we were able to come up with a voluntary partnership of municipalities, service providers, faith-based groups, nonprofits, and businesses to provide refuge from heat and hydration station collection points. But to answer your question, we've seen that there has been an increase of persons who are homebound dying from heat. So we're looking at persons who are disabled, homebound seniors, persons who don't have access to transportation and can't get to these heat refuges. And so people who are home and perhaps they're elderly, perhaps they're low income, and they don't want to turn on the AC. And unfortunately, they perish because of the expense of running the air conditioner, and they die.
Yeah. And obviously, there was that story in the news last week about APS turning off the power of a woman in Sun City who then passed away from a heat-related illness. Are there resources out there for people who are in that situation, who can't afford the air conditioner?
Yes. There are lots of resources available, and we're happy to provide that information. MAG can be contacted. We can provide as much resources in the community, across the region. We know that not everyone has access to internet, or not everyone has a smartphone, but the information, the resources are out there. They do exist.
Yeah. So you have this network, and it's been established for some time now, like you said, but there are some challenges, I'm sure, in carrying this out and filling those gaps. What are they?
There isn't always coverage where it's needed. So we're always looking to expand the partnership and ensure that people always have the access within walking distance. That would be the goal. But unfortunately, because of the nature of the partnership, it's a voluntary partnership, so we can't force anyone to become partners. We open it up to the community, and those who are able to and willing to sign up and become partners, we embrace them with open arms and hope that the community is able to make full use of those resources. But the challenge does exist that hydration stations, heat refuges don't exist everywhere. They're not always readily accessible, so folks can't always walk to them, and so that is a challenge. The other challenge is that more and more we see that agencies are stretched thin, so it's difficult to expect an organization to do it all. No one organization can provide all these services. It really takes the entire community to come together and coordinate with one another to be able to provide these resources to the public.
All right. Maria Pina is the Heat Relief Network Coordinator for the Maricopa Association of Governments. Maria, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ with Lauren. I'm Mark. Still to come this hour, Arizona will be opening three more international trade offices.
Arizona could play a major role in helping Californians displaced by earthquakes, wildfires, or other disasters. Two powerful tremors shook Southern California last weekend, prompting Arizona emergency management officials to go on alert. But Arizona has plans in place to deal with the influx of hundreds of thousands of Californians who could flee their state in case of disaster. In fact, last year, they staged a large-scale mock disaster event to play out the challenges the state could face if the big one hit Southern California. We talked to Wendy Smith-Reeve, director of the Arizona Division of Emergency Management, more about it.
We have plans in place, and as does California and Nevada, and this event would impact all three of those states pretty significantly. So we partnered with California and with Nevada on this exercise, and learning from their previous exercises of their response to a significant earthquake in Southern California, that helped us with planning on what we could anticipate as far as people leaving California, seeking another location or meeting up with family.
Mm-hmm. Why is this the scenario you wanted to test? Like, is this something that is on the top of your radar in terms of likelihood?
Well, it's something that we always need to be prepared for. And it's one of those low probability, high consequence events. So, you know, our standard hazards that we train for and deal with on an annual basis, you know, is flooding, wildland fire, and those types of events. Mm-hmm. So those are tried and true. And so this was an opportunity to test, you know, mass sheltering, mass feeding operations, housing, fuel. People are not going to be leaving with a full tank of gas from California. And if fuel lines are compromised anywhere in between, that's going to be a challenge that we as a state need to overcome in order to help those individuals progress to their final destination, whether it's Arizona or someplace else within the nation.
So there's one thing right off the bat. What kinds of other major concerns are there right off the bat? Like communication, like cell phone lines, things like that? Is that another big one?
Absolutely. And so communication is always key. And so setting up communication points along the route, you know, rest areas are a natural location for people to stop. We can provide water, snacks, and information at that location. Also working with our communication partners, we identified other resources. We knew about what they call cell on wheels, where they can bring in a temporary cell tower and set it up wherever it needs to be. But there's also cellular on wings that we learned about. And so they have something aerial that they can place into an area that provides cellular capability, a certain radius from that apparatus.
So other challenges then, I would imagine medical care would be another.
Absolutely. So medical care, not just immediate medical care, but also longer-term medical care. So what is the status within our own hospitals? where is their opportunity? So when we're sending individuals to those medical facilities, we're sending them to the right facility that has capacity to support their needs, and identify other triage areas where we can provide other medical type assistance that maybe does not require a hospital or an emergency room.
Mm-hmm. How would this be geographically located? Like, you're talking about a wave of people arriving in western Arizona and moving east. Would this be spread out across the state?
So what we would look to do is identify at the time of the event where capacity lies. So what does Flagstaff have the ability to support? What is Phoenix metropolitan area? And in what communities? Because we have a very large area here and a lot of capability in the Phoenix metropolitan area. What does Tucson have available? But also there's other smaller venues as people migrate across. So does Sierra Vista have some capability? So if anyone's going along that southern corridor, you know, it's identifying those primary routes and corridors and opportunities and resources that are available along the way or that we can send in those directions to further enhance those capabilities in those areas.
So much of what you do is about the unknown. I kind of wonder, like, how much can you really prepare and how much can you prepare for, we don't know the answer to that or we don't know how this will play out?
So we have the State Emergency Response and Recovery Plan. That plan has been in place. I think I still have the initial, in fact, I do have the initial document from 1966, but we update that plan every single year. It's available on our website. We have more than 150 partners identified as having roles and responsibilities and capability in that plan. And so we really use that plan as our starting point to understand, here's the situation, here's what we know right now. Here are the partners that can come in and provide support and assistance to help meet these needs. So that's always our starting point. It's our go-to place. But the gold in all of this is the planning process itself. It's making those connections. It's understanding what those agencies, the programs, the services, and the support that they can provide. So it becomes automatic on our end to say, you know, we know these partners have the ability to meet this need that is an identified gap. So let's bring them in as quickly as possible and shore that up so we can move on to the next thing.
All right. Wendy Smith-Reeve is the director of the Arizona Division of Emergency Management. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Arizona will be opening three new international trade offices. State lawmakers and the governor approved $475,000 in the new state budget for trade offices in Chihuahua and Guanajuato, Mexico, and in Israel. With me to talk more about this is economist Jim Rounds with Rounds Consulting Group. And Jim, in general, what does a state like Arizona get out of having an international trade office?
Well, when you look at the economic benefits of international trade, they're large. I mean, it goes back to economic theory, but when you have opportunities for businesses in Mexico to operate in Arizona and you have trade going back and forth, both countries can benefit. But the benefits, the reason that the state government and the city governments like to look at this is to try to recruit these businesses or have a better way of having traded goods come across the border and get processed so we can raise incomes in Arizona. So while both countries benefit, Arizona and the other countries will benefit, it helps us as well, and it usually gives a good return on investment because it, in the grand scheme of things, compared to tax cuts or compared to some high-cost economic development programs or whatever it might be, these aren't nearly as expensive, but they could yield very solid results.
Now, Arizona already has a few trade offices in Mexico. Is there commerce that could be happening that isn't happening now? Are there businesses in Mexico that maybe don't know about Arizona at this point?
I think so. I think that we've improved our relationship with Mexico considerably over the last few years. And so we have a lot of people talking. The governor has done a lot of good work. The cities have done a lot of good work. Maricopa Association of Governments, all these different groups have worked very well to improve our relationship with Arizona-Mexico Commission. So it's not just one effort. It's many. But I think that we're dealing with large countries, lots of businesses. You want to look to attract those opportunities, and you need to do that based on volume. And even though having multiple trade offices sounds like a lot, the word multiple versus maybe one, we're talking about an entire country. I think that this is something where after a few more years and maybe the next economic expansion, we're going to have some good return on investment numbers where we can say, here's what we're getting. Maybe we need to invest a little bit more.
What is the significance of actually having a trade office in a particular country as opposed to, for example, having the governor or a delegation of state legislators or some other delegation of business leaders go to a place sort of on a one-off situation?
They go together. I think, one, the trade office is a tool for more daily type communication, setting businesses up with more specific items. Then you bring in the policymakers, people that are marketing the state, and it's businesses too.
So let me ask you about the trade office that the state will be opening in Israel. What's the potential there, do you think, between that country and the state?
I think it gets back to there are tremendous business opportunities, even when you look at individual cities. When you look at an entire country where we already have a solid relationship with, very small, more aggressive efforts related to economic development could yield very large results. And so if it was, we spent a lot of time just recruiting a particular business from a particular city. I think that we need to be thinking about countries like Israel. But I really liked when, I remember it was maybe a year ago when the Chamber of Commerce, Arizona Chamber of Commerce brought up, we need to be looking at everywhere. We need to be looking at making sure we have good relationship with Canada, Mexico, of course, take care of the China situation. What about Great Britain? What about Israel and others? And so I think that's why we're doing more international travel. I think government officials are sometimes criticized for that, but that's actually a pretty high return on investment effort as well.
Are there particular sectors, and we hear, for example, about high-tech stuff a lot coming out of Israel and the kind of business that Arizona is looking to do with Israel. Is that the sector? Are there other industries that you think could benefit from having an Arizona trade office there?
Yeah, the focus really needs to be on high value added. And so when we say high-tech, people usually think of, you know, computer software services and how you would picture tech. But it also, the same math applies to any high wage industry. So we're not really going there to try to figure out how to import jars for processing of some, you know, a food good. We're doing it to try to have that extra exchange of goods and also the businesses and the money in Israel interested in coming and establishing a bigger presence in Arizona. And these pay huge dividends. We've done a lot of analyses of all sorts of different economic development projects, and one large company location can pay for an entire program like this for a decade.
And are there particular industries you would anticipate the two new trade offices in Mexico to be focusing on, either in addition to or maybe supplementing what the kind of business we already do with our neighbors to the south?
In terms of Israel, I've seen stories related to the tech types of companies that you've been talking about, and I think that's where it would be going. In Mexico, I think it could be a variety because you want to build on your current economic base. And so there's automobile parts, there's high-tech goods, there's all sorts of other things. So I think it'll be a little bit of a broader list for Mexico, but any small increase in economic activity yields huge returns in terms of tax revenue that comes in. So normally, this is where economists lose people when they talk about percentages. Well, what if the job rate or the rate of job growth goes up by a tenth of a percent? Well, if I tell you that's like $3 billion in additional state collections over a 10-year period, then it wakes people up and they say, maybe we do need to think like a business. If government's supposed to operate like a business, like many say, businesses invest in themselves. It's not just about minimizing costs. It's about maximizing profit. And I think that's where we're headed.
All right. That's Jim Rounds with Rounds Consulting Group. Jim, as always, good to see you. Thanks.
Thank you.
At the end of the Mexican-American War in 1848, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo spelled out that the U.S. would respect Spanish and Mexican land grants in the territory ceded to America, including Arizona. It's in that context that Missouri native James Addison Rivas got an idea.
He thought to himself, this is a really great opportunity for me to steal a bunch of land. He was a con artist. So he took it upon himself to make up a Spanish land grant. And he spent 20 years forging archival documents around the world. And he created this whole narrative of a story of a family, and the one thing that he was missing was an heiress. So he found an orphan, or a person of uncertain parentage, rather, in California, whose name was Sophia, you know, a like sort of dark skinned, but nebulous enough that he thought that he could pass her off as Spanish. So he set her up as the heiress to this Peralta land grant, started calling her Sophia Peralta, and married her. And that's how he planned to steal a really good chunk of land. We're talking about an area that's pretty much all of central Arizona into a tiny bit of western New Mexico.
That's Anita Huizar-Hernandez, an assistant professor of border studies at the University of Arizona and author of the book Forging Arizona, A History of the Peralta Land Grant and Racial Identity in the West. I spoke with her recently via Skype and asked what kind of impact Rivas' scheming had before he got caught, especially since there were people living on the land he was trying to claim.
Yeah, so it's really interesting if you look back at newspapers from within Arizona and New Mexico during this time, especially the newspapers in Arizona are very hostile to his claim from the very beginning. And you can trace how this was such an important issue, even though a lot of people haven't heard of it today, that it was something that candidates for territorial office were asked about, what's your position on the Peralta land grant? And this was a big deal for people who were living in Arizona at the time.
So what does this whole incident tell us about, I guess, narrative and the ability to frame and craft and maybe latch on to a narrative, whether or not it's actually true?
So I should clarify that even though this is about a historical case study, I am a literature professor by training. My PhD is in literature, and my interest in this was exactly about narrative and stories. And it's something that I think we all know intrinsically, that the stories you know about a place shape your understanding of that place and your interaction with that place. But I was really drawn to the story as an example of how concrete the consequences are of the narratives that we internalize about a place, whether they're true or not.
So when you look at this story and the story that Rivas was able to tell and the people that he was able to convince, until he eventually was not able to convince them anymore because he had to produce documents and a court took a look at them, do you think that was sort of a function of the times, or is there maybe a more timeless element to what happened there?
So I think both, absolutely. There is an element to, it sounds like a very Wild West kind of story. So it is familiar to us in that way. He certainly wasn't the only person who was doctoring documents, right? He just happened to be a bit more ambitious about it, and that's part of why he got caught. But there are some timeless truths, I think. In the book, I talk a lot about counterfeit narratives, which is what the sort of frame that I use to think about what his particular story does sort of on an ideological level, and how even a narrative that is counterfeit can still have concrete consequences. And specifically, I look at his wife. What I wanted to do was also look specifically at this person who he chose, Sophia, to craft this narrative around and see how that impacted people's interaction with her, people's descriptions of her. And what's really interesting for me as someone who works in the areas of ethnic studies is that a lot of the trial is consumed not only with handwriting experts and seeing if the documents are authentic or not, but debating a person's racial identity. So about half of the trial is consumed with whether or not Sophia is a Spanish person or not.
I'm wondering, in talking about making narratives and the stories that, you know, that people hear and believe, if you see any parallels between this case and some of what we're seeing now with the increased popularity of DNA testing services and genetic testing services, where people and families are finding out that some of the family histories that they've been told over the years and over the generations aren't exactly true.
Yes, I think that is a perfect example of how we have these ideas in our head that identities and racial identities in particular are fixed in time, and that certain families, certain people, certain names, certain locations are associated with particular racial identities. But of course, life is more complicated, like is literally not black and white, right? And so it's interesting to me to see how it throws people for such a loop when they find out that they have these other heritages. Of course, that's going to happen, especially in a space like the United States, but that they can't wrap their head around, or it's just such a paradigm shift to think, oh, the story that I know of my family and the story that I associate with my identity is actually different. And how does that change then my conception of that identity and my conception of my family and my conception of myself, who I am?
How do you think that we should be thinking about that when we find out that something that we thought was true, or maybe even something that we held on to really tightly, isn't entirely accurate, be it something about our family or something about, you know, the history of the place we live?
Right. Yeah, I think something that I was really interested in was taking a case that is extreme, but using it as a lens to think about, well, maybe we should rethink all of the stories that we think we know, right? Personal or more national, right? We think that we know perhaps the history of a place like Arizona, right? But there's a lot more nuance and a lot more complexity there. And perhaps if we knew more of that nuance, more of that complexity, we would have a different understanding of certain, you know, political debates that are happening in the state, or a different understanding of policies that various people propose, or different goals, and imagine a different shared future, right? Because the way we imagine our shared future is necessarily tied up with how we imagine our shared past.
Anita Huizar-Hernandez is an assistant professor of border studies at the University of Arizona and author of the book Forging Arizona, A History of the Peralta Land Grant and Racial Identity in the West. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.